the University of Wisconsin Oral History Department. It's March 26, 2004, and I'm here in the home of Dr. and Mrs. Charles Yale. Dr. Yale was a surgeon at the university, and we're very happy to have you, Chuck, as an oral historian.
Thank you.
We want your story.
Okay.
So start at the beginning.
I was born in Aurora, Illinois. My mother and father at that time lived in Amboy, Illinois. They grew up in Aurora, went to the University of Illinois together. My father graduated with a degree, a bachelor's degree in agriculture, and my mother in chemistry, which was quite unusual in the early 1920s. They went after their graduation, they taught school, high school in Mendota, Illinois for a couple of years, and then my father got a job as a farm advisor for Lee County in northern Illinois, and they moved to Amboy, which was about 15-20 miles north of Mendota. And my mother decided to give birth to me in a hospital, Copley Hospital in Aurora, Illinois, and that's how I came to be born there. My grandmother lived in Aurora, and I suppose that's a reason too. Where do we go from here? Well, I guess I grew up in Amboy. At an early age, my father introduced me to agriculture. I used to love to ride with him as he toured around the country and gave advice on all kinds of things. I had my first calf at 9 or 10 years of age. My father was raising chickens as a demonstration project, I think more than anything else. But I joined the 4-H club and continued on that until I really entered the service at the age of 17.
You had graduated from high school?
I had graduated from high school in, I skipped a grade somewhere between, I think about the 5th to the 6th grade. So I was a little bit younger than some of my colleagues. But I graduated from high school. I was we had a class of about 70. Mm. I was the salutatorian, if you know what that meant.
I do.
Of the graduating school, and from a very early age, I knew that I was going to higher education most likely at the University of Illinois, because like my wife, who also is an Illinois graduate, and her father, we didn't know too much about other schools. We heard about them, but we stayed with Illinois. I went to Illinois right after graduation from high school in 1942 in the spring, and I finished 3 semesters at Illinois. In a program called Engineering Physics, at which time I was called to active duty with the Navy. But they turned right around and said, well, we don't need you to start pilot training now, so we're going to continue you at school. So I joined, I went right back to Illinois, but this time as a seaman, and stayed there for 2 more semesters. So I had 5 semesters of college at the time I went to active duty on July of 1943. Going back to high school, enjoyed high school a great deal, did not participate in sports, but was active in plays and a variety of other organizations. I took agriculture as one of the subjects, enjoyed it very much. This was a small township high school, and the only foreign language we had was Latin, so I had 2 years of Latin. I had no real idea about what I was going to study, although at the time I was a senior in high school, my mother's cousin, who was a general practitioner in Big Rock, Illinois, which is just west of Aurora, Illinois, invited me to come with him, and we went into Cook County Hospital on one day and rambled all over the old Cook County Hospital, even up into the operating rooms, and watched when a woman was having a hysterectomy, which was really kind of exciting. But that was the last, basically, that I thought about medicine until quite a number of years later. Okay.
That must have been quite an experience to see Cook County Hospital.
Oh, yes. It was a rollicking place in those days. I enjoyed that contact very, very much.
So then you became a pilot.
I became a pilot. I went, started and went to the University of Worcester, and then to Iowa City, and then to Norman, Oklahoma, and eventually to Pensacola, Florida. And just after the war ended in November of 1945, I received my wings as a naval aviator and a commission as an ensign in the Navy, and I decided therefore that since I really hadn't seen too much of the Navy, I would stay in for a while. So I stayed in until the fall of 1947, and during that period I went to advanced training at the Naval Air Station at Banana River, Florida, which is part of the Kennedy Space Center now, and then at an advanced training in land-based bombers at Lake City, Florida, then to Hutchinson, Kansas, finally assigned to a squadron on Okinawa, and flew to Okinawa, was there for several months, and then that particular squadron was deactivated. I was then transferred to a ferry squadron, which was based in San Diego, and we ferried planes from Whidbey Island, north of Seattle, to Alameda Air Station, down to San Diego, and eventually over to storage at Litchfield Park in Arizona. The last flight I did was take a twin-engine Beechcraft from San Diego to Wichita, dropped it off, and that ended my career in the Navy. Subsequently, I did join a Naval Reserve Research Unit when we were living in Cleveland. But I had 4 years of active duty in the Navy, and therefore I was not activated during the Korean War. By that time, I was in medical school. Mm-hmm.
How did you happen to go to Western Reserve?
Well, when I got out of the Navy in 1947, I was bullheaded enough to go back to try and get a degree in engineering physics. It would have been 4 years since I'd had any mathematics. I'd had about 40 plus hours of advanced mathematics at the time I got back to the University of Illinois, and I didn't remember a darn thing about it. And it was most difficult to take an advanced course in electronics from the physics department, and I just about went under. But I didn't, and gradually I got through, graduated from Illinois in June of 1949. Helen and I were married in December of 1948, and she had graduated in 1946, and was working for the A.E. Staley Company as a foods chemist in Decatur, Illinois. But we had kept in touch and resumed a courtship, and we're married. And when I was getting ready to decide where I would go to work, the I really had majors in physics and chemistry and mathematics. I knew I was probably interested in science, and I was looking at jobs basically anywhere in the country. And it turned out that the Standard Oil Research Laboratory in Cleveland, Ohio, was looking for someone to work in their engineering department. I went for an interview, was hired, and that's how we got to Cleveland. But at the same time, the connection with medicine was reestablished because Helen went to work in the pharmacology department of the medical school, which was only about two blocks from the Standard Oil Research Laboratory. So after about a year and some courses in advanced mathematics at the university, or at Case Western Reserve University, which was Case University at that time, I decided that we were going to make a change. And so the thought was, well, should you go for a PhD someplace, or I had 4 years of GI Bill that was unused, and it seemed a shame not to use it. I knew I wanted to go to advance in some way or other, and the whole thought of, golly, maybe medical school, maybe we ought to consider that, came up again. So we started talking about it. I went over, and after 1 year at the research lab, I went to talk to the dean of the medical school, which was in the fall of 1950. And Dr. Coy, who was the admissions chairman at that time, said, well, was an old Columbia graduate, and he said, I'm sorry, Chuck, but we're all filled. School starts here in about a week. And but on the other hand, if you want to go to medical school, you've got a place for next year. And I said, huh? And I didn't have any biology to all practical purposes, but he said, don't worry about that, but he said, I think maybe it would be helpful if you went down and took a course in botany and one in basic biology from Cleveland State College, which was downtown in Cleveland at that time. So that's what I did, and then I started, I worked with the Standard Oil Company until the fall of 1951, and started medical school in 1951. And 5 years later, I graduated with a medical degree from Western Reserve University in 1955. By that time, we talked a little bit about what was interested. I always liked things that were had to do with a hand. I suppose that was part of the engineer with me, or in me. But I kind of leaned toward the clinical studies. I knew it was either pediatrics, which I enjoyed immensely, or medicine, which internal medicine, which I enjoyed very, very much, or surgery. And so I went to talk to some of my surgery professors, and they suggested that, well, one of the very best schools for the training of surgeons was at the University of Illinois. It was a school that was founded as an offshoot of the John Hopkins School.
Cincinnati.
Pardon?
You said Illinois, you meant Cincinnati.
Oh, Cincinnati, I'm sorry. If I said Cincinnati, this was Cincinnati, Ohio. And so I went down and talked to the chairman of the department at the University of Cincinnati, the old Cincinnati General Hospital, who was Dr. William Altemeyer at that time. And he was very encouraging. And when the match came out, I went for an internship at the University of Cincinnati, at the old Cincinnati General Hospital. In those days, anybody who wanted a license to practice medicine in the state of Ohio had to have a rotating internship. And so I did a rotating internship. I thoroughly enjoyed those rotations, again, on medicine and pediatrics and surgery. And at the end of the internship, I started a 6-year, 2-month residency in general surgery at the Cincinnati General Hospital and University of Cincinnati. And at that time, they were still teaching basically on the Hopkins schools, which thought that surgeons should be able to do a great variety of things. So I remember 3 months rotations on neurosurgery. I was the head of the fracture clinic as far as orthopedics was concerned. Cincinnati General Hospital was the major emergency room for the whole medical establishment in that part of Ohio. And we had a great deal of time spent in that. The residency was unique in the fact that by the time you were a chief resident, which occurred after 5 years, you were really expected to be an operating and decision maker by yourself. It wasn't that you weren't supervised and had rounds with the faculty, but you made the decision, and if a patient came in and needed a gastrectomy, for example, it was your decision as to whether you did it by yourself or you asked one of the faculty members to come in and help you. You ran the service, and with as much background as we had at that time, I think most of us really felt comfortable. But we did a huge variety of surgery during the residency, an awful lot of trauma surgery. And on the other hand, we had excellent people that we could call in. So you would say, Dr. Altemeyer, I have a case of such and such. Would you be available to help me? And he said, well, when do you think we could do this? And he said, fine. We got a date, and he would show up after I had worked on the patient for a little while, and he would give me the instructions. I vividly remember asking a man by the name of Vinton Seiler, Hoppy Seiler, who was a professor. He was president of the American Hand Society and just a wonderful surgeon. I asked him to come in that I thought I had to do a Whipple procedure, pancreatic or duodenectomy. And he said, well, I'd be happy to help you, Chuck. And so I got going, and about 9:30 he showed up, and about 11:30 we were just about to get the specimen out, and he says, Chuck, you know, I hate to leave you here, but I've got a big clinic this afternoon, and so I'm going to have to duck out. And he says, now what I'd suggest you do is hook this to this and this to this and this to this and this to this, and give me a call if you have any problems. Well, I completed the operation and the patient did just fine. So after finishing my residency, which was 6 years and 2 months long and included rotations in thoracic surgery, so that we were able to be board certified in thoracic surgery if we completed the certification process, and a time of a 3 to 6 month rotation in laboratory surgery, where I worked, and actually it was a process that went along several years during the residency. I did a thesis on intestinal strangulation and eventually defended a thesis for a Doctor of Science degree from the University of Cincinnati, which I got in 1961. So after completing the residency in surgery in 1962, I was offered a job, a fellowship really, clinical investigator in surgery, through the Veterans Administration Hospital, and I was there from 1962 to 64. It was a 3-year program, and during that time, for the first time, we enjoyed breaking out of a small apartment in a metropolitan housing situation and really living as a family in a big old turn of the century house on the on a former military establishment in Fort Thomas, Kentucky, which was just across the river from Cincinnati. By that time, we had four children. Actually, I should say that we had our first child in 1951, as I was about to finish residency or start my medical training, and we had our fourth child during internship at Cincinnati.
You were busy.
She was very busy. Now, how did I get to Madison? Well,
wait just 1 second. Let's back up here just a little.
Okay.
So you came to Wisconsin.
Yes.
And how did you get here?
Well, one afternoon at our home, the phone rang. I picked it up, and they said, "This is Bob Hickey from the University of Wisconsin, and we've heard about you, and we'd like to interview as a possible assistant professor in surgery at Wisconsin." Well, we'd lived in northern Illinois as I grew up. We had vacationed in northern Wisconsin. My family, when my father came back from an assignment overseas of 8 years in Greece, bought a little home up in the Minocqua area of Wisconsin. So we were very partial toward Wisconsin, and it kind of rang a bell. I said, "Well, I'd be happy to come and look and see what Wisconsin is all about," which I did. And Dr. Hickey had been newly appointed at that time as chairman, professor of surgery, and chairman of the Department of Surgery. This was just after a fairly significant problem with the dean position at the University of Wisconsin.
Tumultuous, I think you could call it.
All right. You were here and knew very much more about it.
Yes.
But that
it's known as the Bowers era.
The Bowers era, okay. But he was the first professor of surgery after
Dr. Schmidt?
After Dr. Schmidt, yes. And he came from the University of Iowa, where he had been on their faculty. And we were very enthusiastic at that particular time. And I think one of the things that his interest in me was that while I was in the fellowship after the residency at Cincinnati, I was working in a laboratory where I developed an ability to raise germ-free animals without any bacteria. And I was interested in studying the effect of intestinal strangulation and the various factors that entered into death after intestinal strangulation, and particularly the effect of bacteria on the consequences of intestinal strangulation. Dr. William Aldemar, who was chairman at the university, chairman of the Department of Surgery at the University of Cincinnati, was a very, very well-known bacteriologist as well as a professor of surgery, and just a wonderful man. And I have no doubt that his recommendation influenced Dr. Hickey getting in touch with me. We came to Wisconsin, looked it over, were enthusiastic and said, "Okay, we'll come." So I can't remember what we paid at that time, but this was the first, I think it was around $16,000 for a total year. And the practice—
And it looked good at the time.
Oh, it looked good. And it was the opportunity to continue on with the research and finding out the problems of intestinal strangulation that intrigued me. So I was given the ability, with the help of Dr. C. Stone, who is chairman of the Department of Medical Microbiology, the bacteriology program on campus, the graduate school, they all supported me. I put in a grant to the National Institutes of Health to study intestinal strangulation using the technique of evaluating the effect of the bacteria in germ-free animals with intestinal strangulation. And I received that grant. And as a result of this, I was able to establish the University of Wisconsin Notobiotic Laboratory.
There's that word.
Notobiotic Laboratory.
All right. G-N-O-T-O.
B-I-O.
T-I-C,
which was established first in the basement of the medical school, then moved across the street to Charter, where we had a house that wasn't torn down until the new addition to the chemistry building was put on campus, and from there to a rental space down Williamson Street, and at that time I had a laboratory, or I had a building that had been used as a traveling library for the library system of the county, and they were moving out, and the building was empty. It had originally been, I think, built for a farm. Implements dealership, but anyway, we extensively remodeled the building and established a beautiful laboratory for notobiology, one of the nicest in the country. The use of notobiotics was not very well known, although the University of Notre Dame had done quite a lot of work in this area. And we did a lot of work in establishing the kinds of enclosures that would allow us to particularly take care of the Sprague Dawley rat. We had our own breeding colony. We had our own isolation systems of our own design, and something that had not been done before, trying to establish as a second animal in which to back up the research in the Sprague Dawley rat, the use of germ-free dogs. So we had to find ways to harvest germ-free dogs through a hysterectomy, move them into a germ-free environment, and then rear them until they were usable. I continued as director of the laboratory until 1980. It was the laboratory continued until Dr. Ed Baelish retired about a year ago from the faculty. He was a professor of medical microbiology for a number of years. The recruitment of Ed, who came by way of Cornell and Oak Ridge, was a major find, a wonderful person, an excellent microbiologist, a person whom the Faculty of Medical Microbiology accepted wholeheartedly. And to have a man of that kind affiliated as a faculty member of both the departments of surgery and medical microbiology was a real find. We worked together very extensively, particularly up until the mid-1980s.
We're about to run out of tape here.
We'll stop. The question was, what were these animals used for? They were used to study the effect upon the animals of a portion of their bowel being their small intestine being strangulated. There is a venous strangulation and there's an arterial strangulation, and the difference between the two is rather dramatic. We found that you could take and strangulate over 50% of the small bowel of an animal if you strangulated it by obstructing the arterial supply. But if you obstructed the venous supply, no more than about 15 centimeters of the bowel could be strangulated and have survival of the animal. And the reason was because of the intense blood loss into the hemorrhagic bowel that occurred with venous strangulation. And so the difference between the two was dramatic. Then you add bacteria to the mix, and we have many, many, many bacteria. We found that some of them were relatively benign and others were extremely toxic, and probably the most, the bacteria that caused the greatest problem was Clostridia perfringens, the old gangrene organism. We studied quite a number of different bacteria to the point that we knew what would happen if we mechanically obstructed the bowel, strangulated the bowel in various ways at different lengths in animals in a germ-free state. And then we added bacteria back and studied a lot of monocontaminated results. It became very difficult, we thought, to continue in this way to make any sense out of multiple types of bacterial contamination. When you have literally 100 or more of different organisms in your bowel, what is the how do you study the mix of all of these animals? And we did make some attempts to do some of that, but we felt that we basically accomplished what we were interested in. Most of this work was done somewhere between about 1965 and 1980, a little bit into 1985. This is the principal research that I did of a non-clinical nature while I was on the faculty at the University of Wisconsin.
When you were operating,
yes, I've always carried on a practice,
clinical practice.
The way in which the when I first came here, the only ones that could come to the university hospitals were those that were specifically referred by a private physician or a physician in the community. It was not open. We had no emergency room. The way in which the patients were handled in the university was they got excellent care, but it was pretty much not open to a walk-in the public for all practical purposes. We were responsible for periods of time for the clinical work done in the hospital. And then there were times when we were off service. At that time, you could do a lot of laboratory work. So if you were on a service, you did intense clinical work for 3 months, and then you could get back to your laboratory and really not be interfered with by having to take care of a clinical practice at the same time that you were doing the laboratory work. It was a great society, but the problem eventually became that, particularly in surgery, you had to generate your own income as a department in order to fund your faculty. Also, in order to teach your medical schools, you had to have a pretty active surgical service. And so the question was, well, how do you encourage people to do clinical medicine if the only thing you're rewarding them for is laboratory medicine or an ability to write papers on something as esoteric as intestinal strangulation in germ-free animals. And also, to write clinical papers, you had to do a fair amount of clinical surgery. Now, I had been trained to do I had done a great variety and a great number of surgical procedures. So it was not a question of not feeling competent. But after several years, probably putting at least half my effort into the animal research area in the study of the bacteria and the use of the germ-free animal, I decided that I really would like to get more into the clinical work. And also at that time, Dr. Hickey had left in about 1967 and been replaced by Dr. Carreri. There was still some turmoil in the administration of the medical school, and Dr. Peter Eichmann and Dr. Carreri could not seem to agree as to how the clinical faculty should be enumerated, remunerated, and supported, and exactly how the practice plan should work out. And at that time, I've decided that if this was not going to be feasible, that we could improve the amount or the number of patients that we had in at the hospital, and couldn't find a more or a better means of supporting the surgical faculty, I would have to look for someplace else to practice. And so I became very interested in the practice plan. We decided to revise the practice plan. At that time, I was chairman of the practice plan committee, and we did make a significant change in how the monies from clinical practice were distributed to the individual faculty members and within the department that produced it, as well as in the medical school as a whole. It was very successful, and I decided that we would stay in Madison in the foreseeable future. At that time, we built our home here, finally moving in 1978, I think. Okay.
How many surgeons were there in the department?
Well, I think there were about six in general surgery.
Really?
Mm-hmm. And during that time, we were attempting to develop a transplant service. Bill Kiskin was the original renal transplanter, along with Dave Euling. And we were not only looking for a transplant surgeon for the university practice, but also it shortly became important that we have a new dean of the medical school. Dr. Carreri went to Washington, Dr. Eichmann went to Washington in different capacities, and we needed a new dean, and I was, in addition to working in the Department of Surgery, I was actively helping to recruit a new chairman of the Department of Surgery, served on the committee that interviewed and recommended the new department chairman, as well as the dean of the medical school. And as a result of this work, we were able to recruit a very fine transplant surgeon from the University of California, Dr. Fred Belzer, and a very fine dean who incidentally was a clinical surgeon from, I believe he was from Stanford, Larry Crowley. And I was on the major committees that had to do with finding and appointing those individuals. So I was very satisfied with the committee. And then the question was, well, what clinical kinds of surgery should be done? It's rather silly to have faculty members in the Department of General or Section on General Surgery all trying to do the same thing. There just are not that many thyroidectomies or pancreatectomies or even gastrectomies that we ought to divide the surgery up, at least so that the interests of the various faculty members would be served. And so I did not do any thyroid surgery after we recruited Dr. Eberhard Mack. I was also involved rather extensively in getting Dr. Mack here, as well as Dr. Donald Detmer. These were recruited, very fine recruits, during Dr. Carreri's time as chairman of the department. And so I decided that I would, I did have boards in thoracic surgery, and for a while I helped a little bit in the cardiac surgery, but Dr. Mendenhall was primary the chairman, doing the surgery at the VA, and Dr. Help me. Bill?
Young.
Young. Yeah. Senior moment. Dr. Bill Young was doing intensive surgery in introducing open heart surgery to this part of Wisconsin. And I did work with him at that time. Also, just after I came, the individual who was doing the major amount of vascular surgery left for Milwaukee, and Dr. Pellet had left for a fellowship in England, and so I did a fair amount of vascular surgery at this time. The only vascular surgery that I continued then throughout my career was the surgery in the care of people with bleeding esophageal varices. And I did continue to do that type of shunt surgery, which was a difficult and unusual kind of surgery throughout my my career at the University of Wisconsin. But I was looking for something that was a challenge, and Dr. Carreri and I, basically independently, had an opportunity to do an intestinal bypass as the only surgical option for help in the morbidly obese person. And I decided, well, this is really, really challenging. And so over a period of a couple of years, I did, I think about 60 patients with intestinal strangulation. It turned out to be a really, really bad operation in the long run. Although I will say that perhaps 30 to 40% of those patients did reasonably well so that their surgery was not reversed. But at that time, Dr. Ed Mason at the University of Iowa particularly was developing surgery on the stomach to try to give the individual a very small gastric pouch with the hope that if they would use foods that filled up the small stomach, that they would be satiated enough and help the morbidly obese lose weight. And so for the next 10 years, basically, from about 1980 until I retired in 1991, I did the surgery for morbid obesity at the University of Wisconsin. And during that time, my interest in it was to not only do the surgery, but to follow it extensively, because the surgery, certain types of the surgery, were relatively easy to do by a competent surgeon, but they would do 100 cases, and at the end of a year, they would know what happened to maybe 30, 40, 50 patients, but have no idea what happened to the others, so the follow-up was miserable. So the idea that I had was to follow these patients intensely over a period of time and find out really what happened. And so there are several papers of these kinds of surgeries in the CV late in the years before I retired.
Are they still doing this surgery?
They are. They're, the surgery became popular, and in addition, we pretty well weeded out the operations that were total failures and dangerous to the patients during the 1980s. And the surgery was always done at relatively low levels throughout the whole period up until the present time in 2004. Beginning about 5 years ago, there was a resurgence in the surgery, and it wasn't that new techniques particularly were developed in the basic surgery. It was still mainly operations on the stomach with variable amounts of bypass of the upper small intestine. But we learned through endoscopic techniques to do the surgery endoscopically. And so you didn't have these huge patients with little, with great big operative scars. The idea of doing surgery through small incisions came on about the time that I was ready to leave active surgical practice. So the endoscopic surgery of the gallbladder today is almost totally done endoscopically. I was taught that don't worry about the length of the incision. The incisions heal from side to side and not from end to end, so you do what's necessary to be done to get adequate exposure and do a safe operation. And that was true, and these people with long scars did heal very well. And the problem was that it would take 3 to 4 months until the abdominal incisions were strong enough to support all kinds of activity. So if you had a manual job and you did a appendectomy, which was usually a small incision, but more commonly a gastrectomy or a cholecystectomy, they were out of really active heavy labor for a period of 2 to 3 months. And the endoscopic surgery just completely changed that. So there's been a huge resurgence in the surgery for morbid obesity in the past 4 or 5 years. And indeed, talking to the surgeons at the university, there are at least a couple that are doing quite a large volume of surgery for morbid obesity, and they seem to be very satisfied with it. They are commenting, on the other hand, and the same thing that we found early on, that there are patients, or excuse me, there are surgeons who are doing the surgery that really shouldn't be doing it because they are not adequately prepared to do it, partially, or they are doing no follow-up on what the patients are doing. They operate and the patient disappears as far as they're concerned after the money for the operation is paid.
Oh, dear.
During the early 1980s, when this was a huge, once again, a huge surge in the obesity procedure, we had physicians in our state who were doing a very large number of surgeries. We had one surgeon from the Milwaukee area who was doing so well that he had a Rolls Royce with the vanity plate of obesity, MD. And within a period of about 3 years, he had a dozen lawsuits and was completely out of the practice of doing surgery. But during all of this time, I always did some of this kind of surgery. Now, also, I was doing other things as a faculty member of the medical school. And I served on a whole variety of committees. And I worked as, I was vice chairman of the Department of Surgery for many years. Basically from when Dr. Belzer came until I retired. I think toward the end, my major function for the medical school was on the admissions committee, which was a very interesting, stimulating, occasionally divisive type of committee, but in general, a very important committee that did a lot of good work. And I served on that for, I think, 2 or 3 years just before I retired. Where do we go from here? What do you want to be filled in on?
How do you think the university looks now to the outside world compared to when you came here? The medical school.
Well, from a clinical standpoint, it is a very fine organization with extremely good physicians. It's a progressive organization. I mean, it became clear that you can't teach medical students without an appropriate volume of patients. And therefore, the faculty had to produce physicians in their faculty who are going to be very active. The public was also demanding better and better medical care in the community, and the university has a place in providing that. And I've been extremely pleased at how the school has taken its place in the community. It's been hard on everybody with the health plans that have been developed. This has had a huge impact. The Medicare plans, Medicaid plans have had huge impacts and are still having huge impacts on the university. But as an organization, it's a powerful local, regional medical center. The idea that it was one of the original 13 clinical cancer centers in the country is a testament of what a great faculty we've had. It's my impression that there isn't a department or section in medical school that isn't a very good department. So I'm pleased to be connected. I'm still connected to it as an emeritus professor of surgery.
When we came here in 56 and you came in 60.
61. And 62.
62.
No, excuse me, 64.
64.
64.
The fact that there weren't very many patients was a real handicap.
Oh, yes.
It was a tremendous handicap. And I can remember John Bauer saying this medical school should have been in Milwaukee.
Mm-hmm.
Now I go into University Hospital and you can hardly find a place to park, even though they keep adding parking all over the place. there are many, many more residents. I hear a lot of unhappiness. I hear unhappiness in the community from patients that think they aren't taken care of in a timely fashion. They have to wait so long for this, that, and the other. I hear unhappy doctors.
Well, they're still holdover. I think particularly some departments felt that their whole reason for being was to produce research, but you had to have clinical patients if you're going to produce clinical research. There were our physicians that were always against or felt wronged if they had to give clinical practice and take it away from their quote research laboratories. And yet I think that we have illustrations of in our medical school and in our Department of Surgery of very, very fine departments. I think within the Department of Surgery, the transplantation section is one of the very finest in the country, without any question, which gives service nation and worldwide to patients. And I don't know as you could possibly want a better patient to take care of you than somebody like Minji Kalilo. If you needed a liver transplant. And that all goes back to the days when we were doing our best to recruit a transplantation surgery to do kidney transplants, and eventually got a chairman who was very much interested in that, and of course he pushed the development and made major contributions in that area. Not only laboratory-wise, but clinically. I can't speak for all departments. I hear these comments when patients move from private practice out of the university to the faculty of the university. You can't expect the people in private practice to be very happy about it. There has been huge competitions and organizations have fallen by the way in order to survive dean care. The dean organization has expanded probably at least tenfold in the past 20 years. There's also a tendency of people to blame somebody else. I mean, it isn't my fault that this has happened to me. It's your fault because you didn't take care of me promptly enough, or I demand this immediate service, or why didn't you do this or that? I think the whole idea about how we protect the health of our citizens as a country has to influence the public discussion of this. You put a new appendium to the Medicare bill, and you'd like a drug benefit, and then you get involved in the costs of the benefit and what we can afford. And I think it was Kabler always said that as far as healthcare is concerned, the public wants the maximum amount of health care as long as they can find somebody else to pay for it.
Yes.
Well, my wife and I have been very happy in Madison as a community. There are some marvelous people here. Sometimes we think there are too many experts in on all subjects of which they probably aren't an expert about. But that's what makes an interesting community. The university is a wonderful university, and as a is a place to live. I don't think we could find a better place than Madison.
I agree. Thank you very, very much.
You're welcome.
Appreciate your taking the time to do this.